Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, I'm glad that the scary carb diets have gone away.
Wouldn't work today. Wouldn't work for today's program.
No, I mean, not the scary carb. I'm really talking about the attitude of scaring people with carbs.
Oh, okay.
That's gone away.
Good.
So we got into some really interesting grains. Sets a new bar altogether. Our first guest, who's a very experienced writer, and she writes beautifully, is Alex Medrich. And she has a book that everybody's been waiting for in a sense, called Flavor Flour, which talks really not just about the different kinds of flours you can get, but also the different flavors. Not just textures, but flavors they introduce.
And how to make them all taste good, which some of them don't unless you're very careful.
Well, Alex Medrich, you have won so many awards. You've written so many books, but you really outdid yourself on this one, Flavor Flours. And you explore the realm of what used to be called alternative flours, and now it's called something different, isn't it? It's called
I'm calling them flavor flours.
And we're talking about teff, buckwheat, sorghum, various nuts, non-wheat flours.
A couple of them I never heard of teff.
Teff is, it's more African related.
I found that out.
But, I said to you, I'm just amazed, first of all, how thorough this book is, because you kind of reinvented baking for each one of these grains.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, we had to start with a kind of a blank slate state of mind, which is always really fun. And just, we asked ourselves, and when I say we, I'm talking about my co-author and myself, Maya Klein, we just asked ourselves, you know, what do these grains, flours taste like, and what are their textures, and what would be a really good thing to do with them? What do they want to be? And you'll notice the recipes they're not exotic recipes. They're things that we all know and love. They're,
right,
you know, brownies.
They're that much better because you discovered that these aren't just substitutes for wheat for the people that are gluten intolerant, but they actually have contributing flavors and flavor products.
Exactly. That was a really big part of the point. We wanted to treat them with respect because they do bring flavor and texture to the table, and we didn't want to treat them just as substitutes for wheat at all. So it was a change of sort of just the way we looked at things.
We seem to have been coming across this theme quite a lot recently, and I guess sometimes the recipes with the new flours are successful, and sometimes they're not. So we have a small loaf of what I call laughingly called cardboard.
Uh-huh. Lots of cardboard.
Which is bread based on spelt, which is just about the driest thing you can.
It's not a success.
It's not a success. And yet you can be successful, and you have a whole book that proves it. So,
absolutely. I mean, it's not just about, you know, trying not to use a certain ingredient. It's about using an ingredient and using it in a way where it tastes the best it can taste and feels the best it can feel. Your spelt bread could be absolutely fabulous. Why wouldn't it be? I mean,
spelt is
a beautiful wheat flour, and we know how to make beautiful wheat breads, although my book is not about breads at all. But really, to honor the ingredient, you have to find or create the recipe that works for it and works with it.
Now, how do you do this? Because you and your partner tackled, the book is organized by grains, the different grains. Mm-hmm. But you had to tackle every single recipe, like a blank slate, because you say that the flour reacts in a different way from not only each other, the different flours, but also in every different recipe. How did you work?
I think we did a huge amount of trial and error. Sometimes I jokingly think of myself as a monkey typing. If I do it long enough, I'm going to come up with some words. Because we both know a lot about baking, we looked for recipes that go together and techniques that go together that will create structure. Because none of these flours have gluten, so there is a problem getting them to have structure, to have texture.
Tell us about structure and texture, because you talk about that so much in this book, and it's in my mind, I just thought it was something that held everything together rather than holding it together.
Well, really, that is kind of what it is something that will bind the ingredients together, keep them from falling apart, and give them a nice texture in your mouth that's neither mushy nor cardboardy nor crumbly, which are some of the problems that gluten-free baking often is a problem in a lot of gluten-free baking. So we explored every way to use other ingredients that do create structure. Often in traditional gluten-free baking, a binder is added, and that binder may be something like xanthan gum. Yeah. We use it sometimes.
But not overly.
Overly, and we used very little of it when we did use it, but we also were convinced, and turned out to be right, that there were other ways to get structure, and they weren't rocket science in a way. For example, sponge cakes, which get their structure from beaten eggs or beaten egg whites anyway, work very well for these flours. So in none of the sponge cakes, and by that I mean things like a Genoise or a regular sponge cake or a chiffon cake, none of them require any binder because they've got those beaten eggs in there, and that works to hold these flours up and give them a nice texture. So you'll find lots of variations on that type of cake.
But you have lots of different variations of the flours you use in Genoise, which appears in each chapter just about.
Yeah, Genoise is a sponge cake, and one of the lucky early things I learned in experimenting with these flours is every one of them can make a Genoise if you just get the amounts right. So that was almost like an easy thing to discover, and I was lucky to discover it early on. So almost every chapter has a Genoise or a variation on Genoise.
Right.
And the interesting thing about them is they are so flavorful that, unlike the traditional French Genoise, which is usually just a vehicle for other flavorful ingredients and frostings and buttercreams, these are so tasty on their own that you hardly want to do anything at all to them other than nibble them, or maybe eat them with a little fruit and cream or something like that.
But
that was a revelation.
But you did a couple of things. So you added the ingredients, and you also changed proportions of ingredients.
A little bit. With the sponge cakes, you didn't need to do too much. Sometimes a little less sugar, sometimes a little bit more flour.
Even pans, different shapes and sizes of pans.
Sometimes you needed a tube pan to help the cake rise up the sides, but that's true of sponge cakes anyway. So in a way, we were using the knowledge that we had as bakers and pastry chefs to work with these flours.
Now, some of these directions, for example, you really indicate where the baker has to deviate from traditional things, even in like the mixing together of the ingredients. What did you mean by that?
Well, most of Western baking presumes wheat flour, and in baking with wheat, we are always either working with the gluten, trying to develop it to make a bread, or we're trying to outsmart it and keep it from developing to make a tender cake or a tender cookie. But with flours that don't have any gluten, sometimes you can just throw all the ingredients in the bowl and mix them hard. You don't have to worry about, like pancakes, you know, if you're making pancakes with wheat flour, you have to avoid mixing them too much or they get kind of tough.
Mm-hmm.
But with gluten, with these flours that don't have gluten, it doesn't matter how much you mix them because they're not going to get tough. They don't have gluten development going on there as you mix. So once you have a good recipe and you follow it, you don't have to worry too much about inadvertently developing gluten when you don't want it.
You say, in fact, working with these, everybody makes a big issue about how much more difficult it is because you have to understand the character of the flour you're working with. You point out that even though you work through all that, and which you did, to get it right, that it ends up being simpler than traditional Western
baking.
Yeah,
it was really difficult for us to figure out the recipes that were going to work, but once we did and wrote them down, once you have a good recipe, most of these recipes are pretty simple to put together. There are a couple of project things in that book that require several different mixtures that you might do over a couple of days, but I would say over 90% of those recipes are really simple to put together if you can follow directions and measure.
Well, I'll tell you, there are really recipes here that I lust after, and I don't bake, so I would like for you to move in with us for a while and bake these for us.
Oh, yes, I'd love to come.
I mean,
except you've got bad weather over there, right?
Oh, that's true. You probably don't want to come right now. But one of them I thought sounded heavenly was your lemon tart with the corn flour.
Yeah, that's a tart crust that feels like a little like shortbread, but it's got a little crunch from the corn flour in it. And then it's got a lemon curd filling. What could be bad, right?
Oh, it sounds just heavenly. The other thing is you made me really envious. You know how to make these crackers, seed crackers. I'm like a big fan of Mary's Gone Crackers, which are those seed crackers. Do you know those?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I kind of think these are better.
Well, no, I'm sure they have to be better. That's what I'm saying. I'm envious because I'm sure if I'd like Mary's Gone Crackers, I would love the homemade
crackers.
Yeah,
you're going to love these. You're going to love these. They go together really easily, and then they take a little bit of time rolling out and baking. But once you've done it, you can kind of whip into action and get it done in a reasonable amount of time.
I laughed inside when I started reading a chapter about nut flours, particularly chestnut flour.
Why were you laughing?
Well, there are two reasons. First of all, on one of our early trips together to Italy, we read about this character called the chestnut
woman. Oh, yeah, I forgot about her.
And we went all over the area of northwestern Basilicata province. Looking for the chestnut lady, Donna Castagna, and
Castagna's chestnut in Italian.
Right, exactly.
We never did find her, but on another occasion, we were in a different part of Italy. I think it was Tuscany, and it was chestnut season.
Mm-hmm.
So there were chestnuts everywhere,
absolutely everywhere,
and there were people picking up chestnuts everywhere.
I know. I've been in parts of France where there's chestnuts on the ground. There's so many trees. They're all over the ground.
But the smart ones, the smart old ladies were the ones who were out there picking up the ones that cars had already driven over. So they didn't have to take the green stuff off the outside.
Right. I love the flavor of chestnut. I always have. And it was interesting working on the recipes in this book. I started trying all the different chestnut flours that I could find, and I ordered a lot of them online. And I found out that the most delicious chestnut flour I could find was made here in the U.S.
We're the largest producer of chestnut?
I don't know if we're the largest producer.
Almonds. Oh, no, we're the largest producers of almonds.
Think about almonds.
Oh, we might be. I mean, there's two good places to get mail-order chestnut flour right here in the U.S., and that was a happy thing to find out. So I'm not even buying the Italian chestnut flour anymore.
Yeah, but that costs a penny, doesn't it?
I bet the old ladies picking them up in Tuscany are really mad at you.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Now, there was an Italian recipe with chestnut flour, and I saw, now I can't find it, that I just loved it. Oh, it was ricotta cheesecake,
I do a ricotta cheesecake in the book that has a chestnut flour crust.
That's it.
Which is lovely. I also do a little chocolate and chestnut flour souffle cake that goes together really simply and is lovely with some pine nuts. Toasted pine nuts, if you like them, on top, and I do love them.
Who can afford pine nuts anymore?
And the chestnut genoise is so delicious, you just want to eat it with your fingers, you know?
Now, is your book the one that has a recipe for crumbles in it, too?
Yes.
It has crisps and crumbles, yes, fruit desserts and cobblers.
There's one in particular that has a wonderful piece of advice for everyone who would like to cook crumble successfully, and then you cook the fruit first.
So
you make sure it's cooked right. This is not just frivolous ventures into strange flours and strange combinations. There's a lot of very sensible advice in here on how to just bake pies.
Oh, thank you. Well, baking, all the details make a difference in baking. And I'm faced with that all of the time and how to convey to people in words how to make a recipe turn out as you planned it requires the right language and enough detail to get a person that you don't know to do what you just did.
Well, you actually spell out a lot of the haziness, you get rid of that in your instructions. But I guess where I end up is you suggest that bakers start with your recipes and then move on to their own. I mean, I think once you move away from your tried and tested recipes and get creative with these flours, you might find yourself in deep trouble.
That point is that working with these flours is very non-intuitive. And I know that everyone likes to create a new recipe and play around, and lots of people pride themselves on never following a recipe. But with these flours, which are so unfamiliar to us still, I think that the best bet for success is to pick a recipe that you know works and that you like, and then start to do the variations off of it. Sometimes people get so enthusiastic, they'll see a recipe and they'll say, oh, I'm going to do it, but I'm going to change this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And then when it doesn't turn out well, they either think they have a bad recipe or they're just frustrated and disappointed.
Now, is it possible for people to reach out to you and ask for your advice? You know, I tried.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I have a website, and my email is right on there, so they don't even have to remember my email.
And what is the website?
You just go to alicemedrich.com, and on the page that says Contact, you can email me.
Great.
I'm looking at walnut and buckwheat crackers. I could now substitute black walnuts for that, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Nut substitutions are easy.
Yeah.
But you do want a soft nut, because in the mixer, those nuts get mashed down and get mashed flat. That's why you can throw them in there in large pieces.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes people see the recipe and say, don't I have to chop up the walnuts? And nope, you just throw them in there and the mixer does it.
Right. Now, I'll say that we were talking before, and you were mentioning about searching out for a small home-sized flour mill, and I bet you that's your next book.
That could be my next book, because I did these all with purchased flours, which was just wonderful. But as you get to know and love the flours even more, you begin to wonder what they would taste like if you milled them yourself. And I know some people are doing that, and I haven't done it yet.
Oh, that's a big thing now, yeah.
It is a big thing now, and there was such a lot of work to be done just working on getting these recipes right that we didn't stray off into the mill-your-own-flour part of the story. I think that really this work is, in a way, it's the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to do, even on these flours, not to mention the flours that we didn't cover in the book.
Oh, yes.
So it's a good job you don't have a pastry shop anymore anyway, huh?
Yeah, right.
You'd never have time to run it.
No, I mean, that's just it. I think that one of the things that excites me a lot about this, Maya and I spent the time working on these recipes, and I know fully well, since I did have a pastry shop, that in those days I would never have had the time to do this work on all these new flours. So I know that professionals are going to be able to find ways to use these recipes and riff off of these recipes and introduce them into their repertoires, because everybody in the pastry world and the baking world is interested in ingredients and has clients who are either gluten sensitive or adventuresome
or
to taste new tastes. So, yeah, I'm excited for that kind of contribution
and
to the field.
On by way of closing, I want to note that your photography is also wonderful. If the idea doesn't excite you, the photograph certainly will to make these.
Thanks to Lee Baish, who's a marvelous San Francisco photographer.
So Alice Medrich, it's called Flavor Flours, A New Way to Bake, and it's a wonderful book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Bye, Alice.
Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are, right back. Question now is, how many of you listeners are fluent in ICORN?
Einkorn.
Einkorn.
If you thought the previous interview was detailed, wait till you catch up with guys who dedicated a whole cookbook to one of these ancient grains called Einkorn.
Einkorn.
And you're going to find out some history, and you're going to find out some wonderful ways to use this in your diet.
Shauna and Tim Mallon are in love with each other and with a particular variety of wheat. I guess it's actually the real wheat called Einkorn. Together they put together a blog and also a cookbook called the Einkorn Cookbook. discover the world's purest and most ancient form of wheat. Welcome, Shauna and Tim.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is a really old grain. You gave us the B.C. age of how many, almost 7,000 years B.C.?
7,600 B.C.
Almost 8,000. What distinguishes it from what we eat today as...
Well, einkorn is the original wheat from which all other wheat has been cultivated. So all the modern wheat that we have today has been hybridized from einkorn. And you get different genetics because of that. So when they hybridize or cross-pollinate einkorn with wild goat grass, you got emmer or kamet or farro, some of these 28-chromosome wheats, whereas einkorn's a 14-chromosome wheat. And then they hybridized that again, and they got some of the modern forms, like spelt and all the varieties that you would get at the grocery store now would be like a hard winter wheat or a soft white winter wheat. And those would all be 42 chromosomes. And so the genetics have changed from the original einkorn, and they do that to get desirable baking characteristics and stronger gluten, so better rise, and disease resistance as well. But some people's health has suffered because of the change in the hybridization of the wheat.
Hold on a minute.
Let's not forget, and my wife and I discuss this sometimes vocally, but the idea of hybridizing wheat for to avoid pests and other things like that was very important in the growth of the production of wheat in Canada and places like that. And let's not forget that kind of was viewed at one time as being a really good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it still is a great thing. It's very different than genetic modification. It's not the same thing. I want to make sure I say that. And most people can tolerate hybridized wheat just fine. It's just a matter of the current pesticides they're using on the crops is causing even more problems. But you're right, hybridization has been a great thing to for disease resistance and for a better yield as well.
But coming along with that, and we didn't realize the downside effect, you say, is that there's more gluten and there's more bad gluten for those people who unfortunately suffer from gluten intolerance.
Exactly, yeah. The modern gluten is much stronger. So there's the same amount of gluten in einkorn wheat. It's just a very weak gluten, and our bodies digest it differently. It has a different ratio of proteins that make up the gluten. So it's easier to break down for our bodies. That's the main thing.
But you seem to love the taste.
We do. I mean, we've enjoyed how versatile einkorn is, and it does have a very distinct flavor compared to other varieties of wheat, and we've been able to use it in so many different ways. We've come to really enjoy it.
Yeah, I like Frika. Frika? Do you know Frika?
Sorry, I'm...
Frika, yes.
Oh, yes, okay.
Frika. Yeah, I like that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Well, it used to be that we didn't ever see any of these ancient grains in print. And now there are cookbooks coming out almost daily with people reviving the various types. How economically viable is this for when you're looking at a global starvation rate?
Yeah, I think, honestly, looking at some of the way cultures around the world now are starting to, you know, especially like jovials in Italy, and so they're growing einkorn. They're one of the most, I guess, out in the forefront companies that are...
Oh, I know them, yes.
Yeah, right. I think that is helping to revive economies in places that use heirloom grains and seeds. Now, for us in the U.S., it is expensive to buy einkorn. There's no doubt as far as that goes for people, and that's a shame that some of the most nutritious foods cost more. But then when you look at the subsidies for things like high fructose corn syrup, you know, for a lot of the modern corn, the genetically modified foods, soy and corn especially, it can drive down the prices for those foods so that the people who need to get those end up buying the worst foods. Who need to get the good foods can't afford them. That's something that we've talked a lot about here, and it's kind of educating people on making certain changes in their budget and sacrifices, other things that they might consider that they need in order to get some of these more nutritious foods, because it really does make a difference in health when you have, einkorn's root system is more developed, so it has more nutrients in it. There's some really good research from University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Ellie Ragosa from the Heritage Wheat Conservancy is growing einkorn and showing how many more nutrients are in einkorn than your modern wheat.
Yeah, so Dan Barber talks about this in his third plate, especially about this root system, which never even had occurred to me, that the root system is in modern wheat is so less efficient than in the ancient grains.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So you get more nutrients for your money from buying something like Einkorn.
Now, where is it grown? Is it grown in the United States? Is it particular?
It is grown in the United States.
Is it a particular region?
We know of producers making it in the West and the Northwest as well as in the Northeast. Because it was not hybridized, because it yields a smaller crop, it's harder for farms to get it going. So the largest producer is still probably Italy. But it is being grown in America, and I hope that it continues to grow and become more and more popular here.
Yeah.
Is there any way you could assess, because presumably you had a diet that was based on regular wheat in the past, and now you're substituting Einkorn at every turn. Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea of what the cost effect has been on your household budget?
That's a good question. It's hard to answer because I don't know that we eat as much wheat as like the average American household. We eat like a fairly produce heavy diet, but when we are eating grain several times a week, we're trying to use Einkorn now. It is more expensive. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head exactly how much more we're spending, but our thought is that we would rather have the high quality and less of it than a ton of something that isn't as good for us.
I'm with you.
That comes through very clearly in your book. There's no question about that. And it's really funny. You're talking to a household that can't make toast when it feels like it because we never have any bread. we did get some spelt wheat bread the other day.
It tastes okay, like cardboard.
Yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't like it one bit. It's really dry.
Those spelt chips are absolutely disgusting.
And there's no flavor whatsoever. Now, one of the things that you make very clear is that one of the reasons you love Einkorn so much is because of this amazing nutty flavor.
Mm-hmm, yes, it does have a really great flavor. That said, though, whenever you're switching from working with mainstream wheat to an ancient grain, it comes with a learning curve.
Oh, yes.
And if you've never worked with it before, it can be tough, and you can end up with hard, dense loaves of bread, and you can end up with recipes that don't turn out with a ton of flavor. And so that was part of the reason we wanted to make the book, actually, was to test recipes, to figure out what works well, so that we can give people, you know, here's something to try, and you can use Einkorn in a way that it will taste good. Because it totally has the capability of being delicious, but just like anything, it takes a little bit of time to learn how to work with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it alters the ratio of liquid to
right.
Well, the great thing about it is you've done all the homework. I think it's absolutely terrific. Two things that I thought were particularly interesting. You have one section where you talk about sprouting. Mm-hmm. Do people sprout
Peter's
regular?
Big on sprouting.
Do people sprout regular? I don't. I'm not big on sprouting.
I like sprouted lentils and sprouted quinoa.
I make a melange, I guess, to have with a breakfast boiled eggs, which is mung beans, quinoa, and lentils.
All sprouted.
Awesome, wow.
But we don't sprout them. We buy them.
No, we buy them that way. Yeah. Mr. Whole Foods.
Yeah, I used to be really interested in sprouting all these beans until I found out how risky it can be in terms of salmonella.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of these big production facilities get an infestation and it could kill you.
Yep,
so,
that's right.
In fact, I read where you use raw goat's milk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that could also kill you.
Well, that's definitely controversial. But I can tell you that we've been drinking it. I've been drinking it for 4 years. Tim's been drinking it for
10 years, 10 and a half years now.
Hey, you only go around once, right?
That's right.
I thought the other thing that was interesting is that you soak the berries overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something you would do with wheat at all, is it? With regular wheat.
You could.
You could.
One of the things it helps to do is to reduce the phytic acid, which is like a mineral inhibitor, an enzyme inhibitor, and it produces phytase, which is the enzyme. that helps reduce that. So a lot of people recommend it for regular wheat as well. That's why you'll see the sprouted wheat breads, the Ezekiel breads, and things like that. So you can do that with einkorn as well to just increase the availability of nutrients as well as ease digestion.
But no, I was talking about soaking, like you would soak dried beans. So you soak things overnight as, if you like, as the first step in the recipe.
Yeah, that's the same thing. That's on the route to sprouting is soaking.
I see. So it's in with sprouting. You just continue further in the same direction.
Yeah, right.
Got it.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Now you can of course have einkorn any time of the day or night, and you've made sure that people are hungry. If people are hungry, they'll know exactly what to make. But give us an idea of the overall concept behind what you recommend, which is sort of like breakfast, lunch, dinner, and so on, and a big section on dessert.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to show, again, the versatility of einkorn. So the book is divided into sections based on types of recipes. So there's a breakfast section with things like there's cream of einkorn. There's like breakfast parfaits where we sort of popped einkorn, so sort of faux popping of them to make parfaits. We make pancakes. And then there's a bread section where we have some quicker breads, like a nice sandwich loaf, and then also sourdough breads, which are amazing. They have a great texture. They're very artisanal. And that was one of the hardest recipes to really perfect in the book. And it definitely is one of the ones that comes with the biggest learning curve. But when you get it, it's so good. We love that bread. And then there's entrees, and we make things like risotto using einkorn berries instead of rice, and pizza crust, and chicken on einkorn pilaf. And there's a salad section where we use cooked berries with various different accompaniments to make different kinds of salads. And you can't remember if I'm forgetting something, but then the dessert section, which is every kind of dessert but made with einkorn flour. So cookies, pies, cakes, and so on.
And you figured out the quirks to make it work.
Yes. I feel like it's once you get the hang of it, it's really a wonderful grain to work with. It just takes a little bit of time to kind of get used to.
Now, you haven't made any einkorn beer.
We have not.
Seems like you're missing something here.
Maybe that'll be next on the list.
We've interviewed people with books on ancient grains before, and it seems like there's an awful lot you have to learn about each particular grain has its profile and how you handle it. So you just have decided that this is the one you're going to master, einkorn.
Yeah, I mean, when we looked at the nutritional benefits of einkorn as compared to the other grains, it was sort of like no contest for us. We wanted to use it. And then it was just a short, you know, period of time learning how to use it and practicing and experimenting. And now it's the grain that we use predominantly in our kitchen.
You talk about the difference between the white einkorn flour and the whole einkorn flour. I wonder why you'd want to have a light one.
Well, sometimes we want the texture of cookies or bread to be a lighter one, and when you use the whole grain, it's very hard, even with especially with einkorn, to get something that's not dense. The whole grain always produces a more dense result in cookies, cakes, or breads. And so with the light einkorn, you can get a finer pastry or a finer cookie texture. That's one of the main reasons.
Yeah, well, I mean, if anybody wants to explore nutrition, I think, as well as flavor, from a perspective of something that's been around for quite a long time and continues to perform well, this is Shauna and Tim Mallon, and the book is The Einkorn Cookbook. And congratulations on doing a great, thorough job with this, you two.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, here we are back again. What's up next, dear?
Well, you know, it's really a marvel to see how all these bakeries have sprung up all over the country and all over the world, actually. I call it the new glory days of the bakeries. And there are bakeries that have a devoted clientele, almost even cult bakeries, and one of them is actually the one we're going to be talking about next. We're going to be talking with Aaron Patinkin and Agatha Gulaga about Ovenly, which is a great name, isn't it? Ovenly?
Sure is. Not only that, they did a very clever thing with their website name, because it's oven, and then L-L-Y is the suffix for Libya. And there's absolutely no connection other than that, except that they wanted to be able to include
good,
that in their website name. So it's very, very clever of them. And so here we go with Ovenly.
Ovenly. Here's a bakery and a book that's right of the moment and in the right place, Brooklyn, New York. We're going to be talking to Aaron Patinkin and Agatha Gulaga, who serendipitously met. And that's correct, isn't it? Aaron and Agatha, you accidentally met.
Well, I think it was more kismet that we happened to be in the same food-focused book club. The club was run by Agatha's childhood friend, and when I moved to New York, my friend from college was in that group and invited me to join, and that's how Agatha and I ended up meeting each other. This is Aaron.
Okay, yeah. Great.
And you two discovered you had a commonality in Eastern European food as a background and a sense of adventure. And the thing that I like most about your product and your cookbook is that you have a great sense of balance between the savory and the sweet. Would you like to talk about that?
This is Agatha. Both Aaron and I, we really don't like overly sweet baked goods, and I have more of a savory juice, and Aaron has more of a sweet juice. So when we came together, we really were able to strike a balance in all of our baked goods where nothing that we do is overly sweet. Everything is sweet and savory with a touch of spice.
I like that. That's my favorite, too. You've written this book to appeal to both the experienced baker and also the novice baker. You're known for being the most creative bakery. Who said that? Someone said that you're the most creative bakery in New York. Is that true?
Yes, I think, the subtitle of our book proclaims that, but we have gotten those accolades from a number of different publications, so I think that that's how it ended up on the cover of our book.
They're wonderful, the recipes and the names. Tell us about who gets to name these.
The name the recipes?
Yeah, like Stumptown Shorty.
This is Aaron again. I think that just comes from, I think a lot of the names happen to come from the nicknames we give those items in the bakery, so the Stumptown Shorty really was a burnt sugar and espresso shortbread, but we were making it, we really made that recipe for our friends at Stumptown, and we just started calling it the Stumptown Shorty in our kitchen, and that was kind of our shorthand for the full name, and I think that's kind of the inspiration for a lot of the recipe names, and also we wanted to evoke deliciousness in a lot of those titles, so using words like super rich or sweet and salty or chewy, we wanted people to be not only inspired by the ingredients that each recipe listed, but also by the titles of the names.
You claim that your salted chocolate chip cookies not only are really excellent, you say they're the very best chocolate chip cookies. Who wants to explain how you can say that?
Well, this is Aaron again. It's all subjective, but we spent a lot of time developing that recipe, and I think that we make that claim just because these cookies are so good. They're moist, they're chewy, they're rich. The chocolate is really dark and melty and has that little bit of salt on top, and I think that we just claim that it's the best because we love it so much. It's our best-selling item. It happens to be vegan. A lot of people find that out, and they cannot believe it. And it's our top seller. People come in and they take a bite of it and their faces light up with joy. And we get emails, we get mail about how much people love the cookie. When we were coming out with the cookbook, that was like the number one most requested recipe. And also, actually, Eater came out and a couple years ago and proclaimed that cookie the best pastry in the whole city. So I think that besides the fact that we love it, we have some proof that our fans and that the press love it too.
Now, having said that, please let our listening audience know that you ship.
We absolutely do ship. We have commerce shop and on our website, and we ship all over the country, and we ship our cookies and bars and snacks, and we also ship our Brooklyn Blackout Cake, which is our signature cake, and anyone can buy them all over the country.
And that was Agatha, right?
Yes.
Good.
I'm getting it.
Listeners, you're probably getting it by now too, so we won't make that mandatory in the future.
How about a website for your e-store?
And our Brooklyn Blackout Cake, yes, is also a recipe that is included in our cookbook. And that e-commerce store is just shop.oven.ly.
It's what again?
Shop.oven.ly.
Okay, very good. The ingredients you use are sometimes just, I don't know where you come up with them, but you do use ingredients that add a sort of different level of appeal, such as throwing in cardamom in a routine pear cherry pie.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it special. I mean, you elevate just ordinary recipes to something special.
Thank you. We actually really pride ourselves on using high quality ingredients. First of all, we grind our own spices, and one of the things that Aaron and I really like to do at the bakery is just include an unexpected element in our baked goods. So we'll add an unexpected spice, let's say, or a fresh herb like rosemary or thyme in a scone. And one of our very popular quick breads that we sell in the bakery is a pistachio cardamom loaf. And the cardamom just adds that unexpected flavor. So we like to say that all of our baked goods are classic with a twist. And we think that that twist is something that provides an element of surprise, but it's also fun. So our pastries really do appeal to people with all types of palates. So you can be an adventurous eater, and we really like to encourage people to be adventurous in their eating and also just in their baking. So we really like to encourage people to experiment with flavors. Some of the recipes that we include in the cookbook, we just add other variations to do. So we really want people to have fun with the recipes and add their own unexpected twist. So instead of doing dark chocolate and rosemary, we say that you can do white chocolate or just add some fresh toasted nuts and maybe add another type of spice or add, let's say, a candied ginger or some sort of other element that will just give a fun sort of edge to the baked good. So it's a twist on the classic.
This is Erin. I also think that when we first set out to start Ovenly, we never wanted to do something that everyone else was doing. I mean, I really respect people who say, you know what, I want to do traditional French pastry and make it the best traditional French pastry. We really wanted to take classic American and Eastern European recipes and do something innovative with them. So everything that we do is complex, but it's not complicated. And the reason that we do it that way is that's what we like to eat, but we also want Ovenly to be identified not only for its logo and its look, but for its baked goods. We want people to be able to pick something up and taste it and be like, this has to be Ovenly. It's so delicious. It's so unexpected. It's so amazing.
That's great.
And this has got to come from my favorite bakery in Brooklyn.
Now, you have one interesting product. I can't remember the full title, but essentially it's a solid Bloody Mary. Can you explain that one?
It's a Bloody Mary scone, yes.
It's a Bloody Mary scone.
A scone.
or a scone, depending on where you are. But what's a Bloody Mary? I mean, is it a substitute for a real Bloody Mary, or do you have them side by side, or what's the deal?
This is Agatha. We came up with the recipe because we spent, when we were first starting to do a lot of wholesale orders, we spent about 18 hours a day in our kitchen, and that meant that we barely left, and we were surrounded by a lot of sweets and nothing really savory around. So we were also working on the weekends, and one of the things that people like to enjoy for brunch, especially in Brooklyn, is a Bloody Mary. So we were creating a lot of different types of flavors of scones, and scones you can make savory or sweet, and we decided that a Bloody Mary scone would be a fun twist, just a traditional savory scone. So the elements that go into the Bloody Mary scone are fresh pureed tomato and some fresh grated horseradish and a lot of spices and red pepper flakes, and it essentially tastes like a Bloody Mary but in scone version.
Wonderful. Tell us about your bar snacks. I think that that you have like a whole line you could capitalize on with your bar snacks. Tell us a little bit about how they came about and what kinds of things to expect.
Well, you know, this is Erin. We started Ovenly as a gourmet bar snack business and first started approaching our first clients were friends. One of them had a bar in Greenpoint and the other one was the marketing manager for Brooklyn Brewery. And when we first started, we thought we would only be making bar snacks. But it just so happened the first client we actually started to do work for also had a cafe in the morning. And so she asked us if we would like to do our pastries. And that's how we ended up being a bakery. But we've actually kept the bar snacks more. Our main focus is baked goods. It's what took off. Our main business is from high-end cafes and coffee shops that sell great coffee that want good pastries to pair with that coffee. But the bar snacks really we kept on as more of a homage to our beginnings because that's what we hoped how we would be. But it's not really the main focus of our business. That said, they're amazing and wonderful.
I want that peppery pistachio brittle.
Oh, that's so simple and easy to make. But one of the things that we set up our kitchen because we have a commissary behind our retail shop in Brooklyn, really to be a bakery. We didn't have the equipment or the know-how on how to do like large batches of candied popcorn or brittles. And we really wanted to, at some point, we really just had to decide to focus. And we did focus on the bakers because it was really 99% of our business and the bar snacks were such a small part of the business. So that said, we still do a few. We do the maple time pecans and we do the old salties in-house. But, again, it's more for fun and as an homage to our original idea.
Well, what happens next?
With Ovenly and with the company?
Yes.
It's a good question. This is Erin. I think that Ag and I are still talking about that. I'll let her chime in, too, on what she thinks. But I think the next thing is to – we have the main part of our business, again, is wholesale. So we service over 100 different clients every single day, 365 days a year. And so we're finding that we're running out of space. So I think we'll probably be opening another kitchen soon and with another small retail location attached. And I think that we'll be looking towards opening a couple different spots over the next few years. And, you know, potentially, hopefully, we might do another cookbook in the next couple of years. I think we have some ideas, not only under the Ovenly brand, but some individual ideas. And I think we're really looking to be creative. And it's to grow the business and to be creative in our personal and professional careers.
Well,
that sums it up very well.
You want to add anything to that, Agatha?
Nope, Erin summarized it very well. That really is our plan. We would actually the one other thing is, as Erin mentioned, we have a very large wholesale business and we'd really like to continue to expand that. And most of what we do now is within New York, and we'd like to go beyond New York and potentially start wholesaling to Connecticut and Massachusetts and some of the bordering states.
Yeah, but you got to sign on to the Fancy Food Show, although it's expensive.
Actually, we were just looking at the application yesterday.
We were.
Yeah, well, let us know if you do that, because we always cover the one in New York.
Okay, great. Oh, we will. Definitely will.
Well, I mean, I think that both of you have a lot of personality, and your shop does, your product certainly does, and this book, Ovenly, Sweet and Salty Recipes from New York's Most Creative Bakery, has a lot of personality, too. And congratulations on this, your first book, and hopefully we'll see others after this.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Agatha.
And thanks for having us.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now we're going to finish up with something completely different.
Yeah, it's different.
We've been saving this for just the moment when you tried to figure out what to buy for your children or your grandchildren, of course, depending on how far along in life you are. In our case, it was our grandchildren. They were absolutely delighted with this absolutely fascinating storybooks about two chihuahuas who travel around the world exploring, finding out about things in foreign lands. And it's just really, they're actually absolutely charming books. And you're going to fall in love with Bella and Harry for yourself if you're not careful.
Lisa Manzioni says that once she came up with the idea for this series of travel adventures for children, everyone laughed. Now, why would they laugh?
They laughed because, well, a couple of reasons. One is I'm born and raised in Arkansas. And, I guess people in Arkansas aren't really good history writers. And two, I'm an accountant by trade. And just the whole thought, just everybody just thought it was funny. Just funny, funny, funny. So I wanted to surprise everybody.
Well, you sure did. Yeah, you're on which book now?
Guess who's laughing now, huh?
That's exactly right. And it's funny you say that, because when I made my debut on QVC, I had to point it out to everyone, my daughter and my son. By the way, guys, you see Mom on QVC, so.
Yeah, I remember announcing to my son in front of his roommates in college that he could check out Mom and Playboy. He was totally mortified. You can just imagine.
It was. I should quickly point out, listeners. It was not a pictorial. But she has actually been in there. She's been published in there twice.
Oh, nice! Well, you got their attention, didn't you?
I thought that was very good.
Very funny.
So anyhow, how did you set out with these characters? Now, let's explain, because nobody can see these. That you have two adorable little Chihuahua dogs. The fluffier one is the older sister, mm-hmm. and the other one was the younger brother, obviously, and they're called Bella and Harry, and they go, they travel all over. They love to travel.
They do. It's funny. The two dogs, really, they're based loosely on my children and their personalities, but the series really stemmed from the fact that our children today, I don't feel, learn as much about geography in school as I know I did when I was in school.
They don't learn anything at all. That's like the canceling education in geography all over, not just elementary school and middle and secondary, but universities.
And oh, well, yes, absolutely.
My husband's a geographer by training.
So we'll have five generations of Americans who think Canada is the 51st state, and if you ask them which way to point out which way it was, they'd probably point south.
That's exactly right. And that's why I started this series. I came back from vacation, and I was messing around. My son and I, he was getting ready, believe it or not, with friends, okay, to leave to go to college. I had just come back from Paris from the French Open. And he said, yeah, that's over in Germany someplace. And I looked at him. Yes, absolutely. And I'm looking at him. I said, you're joking, right? And he goes, no, it's over there somewhere. And I said, oh, Michael, too much football. What are you doing? His sister, you know, now she's an honor roll student. And she really had no idea either. So the more I looked into it, I thought, well, you know how sometimes you just want to do something good, something to make a difference somehow, some way. So I thought I would write this series and maybe just pique a few children's interests out there for them to maybe read the books and think, hey, wow, let me look into this on my own. Or, you know, there's a lot of homeschooling and that type of thing. For parents just to expound on it, or, you know, summer programs in the libraries and that type of thing. And it was just really a fun way to teach primarily kids in the U.S. because I think we are really, we're the deficient ones.
Really bad, yes.
Yeah, just to give them an introduction.
Now, our granddaughter, who's seven, she's carried around with her for I don't know how long, a book of flags she was very young, wasn't she, Rabbit?
Yeah.
She started with this. And so, and Peter and I travel a lot.
I don't know where she got the idea. I really don't. I don't know why.
One of her parents gave it to her.
Yeah, I'm puzzled about why they did that. Now, she's always been interested in maps. In fact, I have another world map to give her, I think, when they come up here in July, because mysteriously they seem to get torn. I don't know why.
That's our grandson.
Hopefully that won't happen to the books, because we hope they're all going to a good home. We have quite a stack of them.
Oh, wow. Tell me how many in the series.
Right now there are 12 in the series, and there will be two more added by the end of the year. Maui, Let's Visit Maui, just came out, and that is our only U.S. title. In October, we'll be visiting Let's Visit St. Petersburg, Russia, and Let's Visit Vancouver, Canada.
Well, I mean, I think it's just a wonderful idea. Now, what age were you aiming for when you're writing this?
Five 5 to 10 primarily. I think that the ideal age is 2nd and 3rd grade, so 7, 8 years old. They can probably read the book on their own. I think you probably noticed in most of the books in the back, there's a few fun vocabulary words of the language
right.
that's particular to that country, with
right.
the exception of Cairo. That one has a hieroglyphic alphabet, so the child can learn to write their name in hieroglyphics because the Arabic was just
oh,
too difficult.
Oh, that's great. So I don't have that one.
Oh, you don't have Cairo? Yeah, and
no.
that one, that's what was in that one. But we try to introduce you to just some fun words like ciao, buongiorno, just little fun things.
Yeah, we're always being asked that by our grandchildren.
You did have a funny thing in the one on Rome. You had a word for part of the Colosseum, which is not exactly part of everyone's vocabulary.
Yeah, that was really obscure.
but you did explain what it was, and I'm pleased to say mm-hmm. that even though I didn't recognize the word, the picture gave me a clue, and I said it must be that.
Yes.
Now, well, you've been to all these places, is that?
I have.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And,
yeah.
Do you do that as part of your research for each book?
No, not really. It's funny. I think I have my favorite places. I've been fortunate. I've been able to travel quite a bit. And I think I have my favorite places, and that's what I have a tendency to write about. And I'm sorry, I didn't know you didn't have the Cairo book, because the Cairo book, believe it or not, is my absolute favorite of the entire series.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. I will send it to you after later on this weekend. Because,
oh, yeah.
And I think it's – I don't know what it's from. I had such a different – trip when I was in Egypt than I see everything on TV, and it's just
that's
heartbreaking.
Yeah, they asked me which ones I wanted, and I thought, I mean, that Cairo is not a great thing to be discussing now. I mean, next they're going to start tearing down all the monuments, you know, it's awful.
Mm-hmm. And it was just absolutely, I found the people and the entire environment when I was there. I traveled all throughout the country. Just wonderful. And it's just so sad, because what you see on TV is not what I felt when I was there for 2 weeks. And the pyramids were amazing. The Valley of the Kings was amazing.
I've always wanted to go, but, you know, this
amazing.
Is not a good time to
Not a good
go.
Time, right.
Well,
yeah.
Is there any truth to the rumor that you had Baghdad was in the works, but you decided to abort?
No. No, not in the works. But you know, there is some.
Went to the same place as Damascus.
Well, it's funny. I hear that Libya, you know, I watch a lot of the history shows on TV and that type of thing, and I just happened to stumble across one on Libya about some of the beautiful ruins they have there. You know, and I hope it's someday, you know, we'll be able to actually see them and enjoy them.
Look at Syria. There's not going to be anything left of Syria.
Yeah, they have some nice modern ruins, too.
Yes, unfortunately, yeah.
So, now, I've opened up Rome, since we were talking about Rome. Now, how do you go about, the first thing you start talking about, here are these adorable little chihuahuas.
Uh-huh.
I want to mention Christine Lucco is your illustrator, and she does wonderful, charming, attractive, vibrant illustrations throughout, which contributes a lot to the charm of the books.
Thank you.
And she's remained your illustrator for each one, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
She really brought Bella and Harry to life, so to speak, on paper. Mm-hmm. And I love what she did in the Rome book. I don't know if you've noticed, but Harry wears the gladiator helmet through the entire book.
Yes. No, yeah. I thought that was so cute, because that's exactly what a little boy would do.
Exactly. And it's just so cute. And
very
jumps
very
in the
sensible thing to do. I mean, why would you want to take it off like a girl?
Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, he did take it off one time, and that's when he jumped in the Trevi Fountain to collect all the coins.
That I thought was so typical, too, because kids are doing that all the time.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that
and,
one. I mean,
grown-ups do it all the time.
you're encouraging illegal activity.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, she says, Bella says that you can't do that.
Well, you
can't.
Right.
No, Bella said that you throw the coin in so that you can come back, and so all these other people want to come back, too. That's true. So, okay, so you pick out in your head, you think, what is important?
So. Right, I try to, yeah, three or four different landmarks in each city, something that the child can relate to if they see it on TV. You know, like, you know, in Rome, if they see the Colosseum, they'll think, oh, no, you know, Bella and Harry went there. I know that's in Rome. Or, you know, or something that will make them, you know, want to maybe even look into the country a little bit more, like if they see the Trevi Fountain or if they see the Colosseum or, you know, something, you know, let me Google that. Let me see what's around there. Let me see what's in Italy and exactly where it's located. So in each book has a map of the general area
right.
to give them an idea of where they're at. And Bella and Harry always have to look at the map to see exactly where they're at.
Now, where did you have in London?
Where did they go in London? Well, they went to the Tower Bridge, okay, because we all know that is not London Bridge.
Right.
Right? A lot of people think that it's Tower Bridge. Of course, they talked about Big Ben, and they went on the double-decker bus, and they took the train, actually, from the city, the exact train route that you would take from the city of London out to Stonehenge and back.
So oh, wonderful.
You, you know, yeah, you go to Salisbury Station, and I do it exactly as you would if they were really in London taking the train.
Oh, that's great.
You know, the other thing that's so cool is each one has its own little sign in this book belongs to
right.
with the theme of the country.
Right. Well, I remember from my own books, from the Golden Books, you know,
yeah.
in the 60s and
oh, 70s. Yeah, right,
I loved
right.
that. That was my favorite part. I could put my name in my book. And I thought, hey, it's a little retro, but that's what makes the book yours.
Let's just run through some of these titles again. And I mean, is the website is mm-hmm. what?
It's www.bellaandharry.com.
Okay, so the best approach would be for somebody to go on the website who's interested mm-hmm. and see all the places that you have,
mm-hmm.
the cities. And,
yes.
And each one is just a delight. And I think that this will be a popular teaching tool, as you said. Do libraries stock this book?
Yes. Libraries and schools have been probably our biggest sales. We offer lesson plans that meet the Common Core standards and the Florida Sunshine standards for free on the website. So the libraries, the schools, they can download them. There's a Venn diagram. There's a crossword puzzle. It's a fun additional learning tool that a lot of the libraries have really enjoyed using over the summer for the fun programs they have for the kids for summer camp and that type of thing. And, again, they're no charge. There's also activities on the website. You can help Bella pack her bag. There's a flag match. Funny you talk about that. You should take your granddaughter on because there's a flag match to see if she can match her flags to the particular countries.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, so that's
She's
cool.
She's good about that, actually.
Yeah. And we've just been really successful and just really well-received, which has been really great because we've won the Mom's Choice Award for all of the books, which means that they're family-friendly books. They're approved by moms who want their children to, you know, grow and learn. And we're also part of the Reading Rainbow online program. Do you remember Reading Rainbow on PBS with LeVar Burton?
No, I don't actually.
No? Well, there's now a website with Reading Rainbow, and the books are actually interactive. And the books, you can have them read to you by a young lady who tries to imitate Bella, if she could speak, or the child can actually read them themselves. So that's a great, great thing, too. And we're trying to get that in all classrooms throughout the United States. So each child has a book or some type of learning tool in their own hands.
Well, you have a wonderful success on your hands. This Greece is another, Athens is another one. You have the Minotaur. I mean, there's so many wonderful quirks and a great sense of humor running through all of these books.
And oh, thank you.
I wish you continued success. It'll be a while before you run out of cities, I bet.
I hope so.
Well, Lisa Mangione, remember now, Bella and Harry, Let's Visit, mm-hmm. and then followed by a major world city. And I just can't even thank you enough for coming up with this in the day and age when we're all struggling with geography and what's where.
Well, thank you, and I hope everyone enjoys them. And Cairo is going to be on its way to you because that is, as I said, my favorite book.
Well, you were lucky enough to get there.
Yes.
Anyhow, well, thank you again, Lisa.
Oh, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just to prove again that On the Menu Radio is a program for all ages and all persuasions.
And also for travel, which we don't always emphasize.
Right. Yeah.
But anyhow, this is it for today. Huh?
Yeah, our grandchildren have a full set, by the way, and they love them all, so yours will too. And until the same time, same place next week when we hope we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.